This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
John Lee Anderson is one of the most incredibly intrepid people you could ever meet. He's reported on war zones and four continents for The New Yorker and other publications. And he acquired his comfort with travel very early. His father was a diplomat and Peace Corps official, and John Lee was raised in half a dozen countries. When he was a young man, long before he went into journalism, he took himself to a remote part of the Amazon jungle in Peru, journeying up the river called Madre de Dios.
I had an unusual upbringing. I had an inordinate admiration for people who were able to do things with their hands, to hunt, to live off the land. And from a quite young age, 11, 12, I had been trying to do it. My parents had tried to facilitate it where they could. So I spent a year in Africa when I was 13. And I'd spent a year on the Mosquito Coast, 17 and 18, living and working as a machetero, as a peasant, earning a dollar a day with Garifuna people on the coast of Honduras, and learning how to climb coconut trees and use a machete and to fish in a dugout canoe. And I had a great admiration for people that knew the forest, knew the wilderness, and could survive in it. I felt like I was a city boy wanting to learn the original secrets of life. It's funny because I realize as I'm talking about this that this is the stuff of, you know, adventure tourism and even television shows now. And it just wasn't then. I first went to the Madre de Dios when I was 20 years old. So it was in the late 70s, with an idea to go upriver to where, you know, in those days we still talked about wild Indians. And I was pretty gauche, and I thought that would be, it was something I'd always wanted to see. I wanted to see the original world. I was young. I was not yet a journalist. I had had a couple of years at college and left to go to South America to explore. So I hired a man to take me upriver into what was called the Manu Forest. It had recently been declared a national park. It's part of the river head of the Amazon in the corner of Peru, neighboring Brazil and Bolivia. It's a vast region, a kind of an amazing biosphere that is also home to some of the world's most isolated people. And I camped on a sandbar near an Amaricaire indigenous village. I'd been told that they were unfriendly and they weren't hostile, but they were, they didn't meet my eye. You know, I knew that they were not happy at seeing me there. I now realize that what I was seeing was a community that had been devastated in the previous half century. The Amaricaire had been one of the great warrior tribes of the region. By the time I went there, there were about 500 left. I wanted to go further up. This was still the main river. I wanted to go off into the tributaries. It was like getting off from a highway onto a trail, really. And we did. We went up the Manu River, which is then into the national park. I forget whether it was our first or second night up the river, but you know, these are long days in the canoe. And there were suddenly two men on the shore. I remember them as incredibly strong, fit men. One in particular, I'll never forget, he had this black hair. It was like a mop on his head, and it was cut ragged around his shoulders. And they were standing over a dead peccary, a wild boar. And my boatman hesitated, but we stopped. We hadn't had meat. In the end, we had a meal with these two men who were, for me, of an unknown tribe. And we had no means of communication. And they just stared at me all the time. And at one point, I remember looking across at this one man who particularly fascinated me because he was so strong looking. He'd cut off pieces and we were eating them. And he had the actual bone, the actual shank, and was holding it with his feet. And with his arms, he was chewing off the rest. And I thought to myself, this is a glimpse of ancient man. There we were. That was it. I returned to the Madre de Dios this time because of the mysterious appearance over the last several years of the Mashcopiro Indians. For almost 100 years, they remained in the forest. And, you know, there were occasional appearances, but it wasn't until the last 4 or 5 years that the Mashco had been repeatedly coming out. Even adventure tourists had begun to see these people who would appear on the riverbank. In some cases, they would be threatening. In other cases, they would be just staring at them. There was an incident in going back to 2011 where they killed a man. In the years since then, there had been more and more sightings of them. And then suddenly, this last year, they killed, with a bow and arrow, a young man in a village of Machigenga Indians. Now, the extraordinary thing is, as I say, that for about 80 to 100 years, the Mashco had disappeared into the forest. Now, suddenly, they're coming out. So anthropologists and others, the zeitgeist is full of papers and findings and debates about what's going on. Why are these people coming out? You know, they're now prey to drug traffickers, to men seeking hardwood timber, which is worth, you know, hundreds of thousands, a single tree, and so on, gold, diamonds. The speculation was that the Mashco were coming out in distress, that they were coming out because they can no longer survive inside. There was a kind of growing consensus and an alarm spreading that perhaps, you know, it is the end time for these people. So the Mashco coming out forced the government to address the situation. So that meant that the government, through its culture ministry and its recently created Office of Isolated and Uncontacted Indigenous Peoples, staffed by a handful, literally a handful of young anthropologists with almost no budget whatsoever, now we're forced to consider making contact with the Mashco to find out what the problem was, why they were attacking, why they were coming out. And so they began last summer to make what they called expeditions of controlled contact. They have an outpost on the river, and through native interpreters from the Jine tribe, who are basically cousins of the Mashco, they've convinced them to make their appearances there. The outpost is up a high bluff, and there's a longhouse there with a water tank and a generator. And they have a bench on the edge of the bluff, and they spend their days looking across to see if there's any appearance by the Mashco. The first time I saw them, I saw a mass of naked people standing against the white scree of rock of the far riverbank. This was maybe the fifth or sixth they had had in such encounter when the scouts and the anthropologists arrived on land. they were immediately besieged by the group in a friendly way, because they knew them now, particularly by the children who climbed on them. They were inspecting them. They searched their bodies. I noticed that one of the scouts, one of the Jine women working with the anthropologist, is named Nelly. She's quite a chubby woman. And I noticed that the women were sort of kneading her breasts. And then Rommel, the sort of lead Jine scout interpreter, we watched as the children sort of made him run with them and do races. Anyway, there was all of this milling around. There was a lot of playing. You could see that they were also making faces to one another. Usually this would be the children with Rommel. The adults would come up and watch this. And then sometimes they would join in too. And I could see the anthropologist asking questions. Back at the camp, back at the post, I asked Nelly what was going on. And then she said, well, they saw how fat I was. And they said, you're pregnant. And I said, no, I'm not pregnant. I'm just fat. They didn't know what that was. And one of the women said, well, I am. And she squeezed her breasts and squirted her breast milk in Nelly's face.
Así, las chicas lo hicieron así.
No les has visto, estaban ahí con sus tetas.
No me digas.
It was this kind of haphazardness. But they had begun to get pretty much register who was who. They knew who the leader was, and he was there that day. I immediately recognized him. A young man, about 22, tall, called Kamotolo. And they talk a lot about Kamotolo. They say that Kamotolo seems to understand that the outside world is right there, that it has certain benefits. He'd always expressed a lot of interest in their canoe. He would often go and sit in it. Two things that had emerged. The Mashko did not swim and could not fish. They had no canoes. They lived in the forest. So this is very unusual. But so far, they'd been frustrated in just discovering why they were coming out. The team, you know, they worried about the fact that they weren't in full control of this idea of a kind of pure contact. The lead anthropologist, who was Luis Felipe Torres, a young guy, was full of sort of self-doubt about whether or not this was a good thing, but he didn't know what else to do. It had fallen upon them to look after these people. So, you know, here you have had a young, you know, progressive Peruvian from the city who'd learned anthropology, but felt a moral quandary about whether what they were doing was ultimately right. They were having to respond to them because they had killed someone, because there was a clamor from the communities where these people had been killed that these people needed to be reined in. After this visit, for the first time I saw the kind of fragility of their existence there and their vulnerability to the outside world, because there was a doctor who was part of the group as well, and he was really concerned because he said two of the women had coughs. And he began to work on a kind of an emergency plan in case they had begun succumbing to flu. And he told me there was a 3-day rule with indigenous communities. I asked him what he meant by that. He said they begin dying within 3 days. The children in particular begin to die just like that. They drop like flies within 3 days. And he said he knew that eventually there would be an epidemic and it would be devastating to the Mashko. So they agreed to come back again. We'd been waiting for them. It was the day they were supposed to come, and they didn't show, they didn't show, they didn't show. And then finally, I heard this excited roar, and there they were. But this time it was different. This time, only 3 men appeared. Kamotolo, another, and a boy. And the older man walked sideways to the edge of the forest to a group of bushes, and he kind of hid himself there. The anthropologist was really worried, and he said, you know, this is this doesn't look good to me. They might be planning an attack. Where are the women? And he explained to me that in the history of these encounters, this kind of controlled contact thing, that in the past 40 years, there have been 60 scouts killed by indigenous peoples. And usually the attacks occur at this stage in the contact. As they were getting ready to go in the boat, the women appeared and the children. What I felt I saw on this trip was a glimpse of the original world as it's ending. People are no longer metropolitan, you know, urban Americans, Peruvians, everywhere, are losing primary experience. We're no longer having direct contact with the original world. Where I was, it's still there. The very original world, before all of our history, before Columbus, before Christ, before all of that stuff, how we were when it was just us and nature, it's disappearing, and it probably will disappear, if not in our lifetimes, in our children's lifetime. It's going. The Mashkopito are coming out of the jungle. There's only 100 isolated groups left in the world. 70 of them live in this area of Peru and Brazil. This is it. This is the end. That's an extraordinary thing.
Staff writer John Lee Anderson. You can find his article about the emergence of the Mashkopiru at newyorkerradio.org.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.